What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Professor Mark Kligman, world-renowned expert on Jewish music. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavenah on Israel, Oshrat Morel, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You can make a good case that Jews focus too much on holidays, from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to Sukkot, Simchat Torah, Chanukah, Purim, Pesach, Shavuot. Each is wonderful in its own way, and at times it seems that Jewish education and religious experience is just transitioning from one holiday to another. But sometimes we even add non-Jewish holidays to our calendar, and this week is certainly a wonderful example of that. It's rodeo week out here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West where I live, so I thought we'd start with a Western theme this morning. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is in Tucson unless you live here and have lived here for at least a year or two, or 17, like me. While sometimes in the Southwest we get a little testy about the stereotypes of cactus, desert, and cowboys, we tend to have foisted upon us. Occasionally, we actually seek out and embrace those stereotypes. This is one of those times. So, how do you say yippee-ki-yay in Yiddish? Yippee-oy-vey, perhaps? Anyway, here in Tucson, our rodeo week is a big parade, the world's largest non-mechanized parade, for what it's worth, followed by a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days, go to the parade, wear cowboy boots and hats and such, and generally pretend that we still have a connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. To most people in America, let alone most Jews, the idea that schools are out for 2 days this coming week for rodeo, of all things, seems absurd and beyond archaic. Do you close for the county fair out there? And yet, when you live as we do in the heart of the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country about a century ago, rodeo is still a big deal. You might not immediately associate Jews with cowboys, but it's worth noting there were plenty of Jews, even in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman Wyatt Earp's common law wife, his last one anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. There were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, even outlaws. If you aren't sure, go visit the Boot Hill Jewish Cemetery in Tombstone. It's fascinating. And, of course, those ubiquitous jeans that everybody wears were also pioneered by a Jewish guy, Levi Strauss, a Jewish immigrant from Bavaria who came to the gold country in 1850 and co-invented the denims that sat on all those saddles that blazed through the Wild West. He and his partner, another Jewish tailor named Jacob Davis, he's the one who patented the rivets that hold on the pockets. They made Levi's the preferred pants of cowboys from gunslinger days right up to today. So in honor of all those Jewish cowboys and characters and rodeo, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West, the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big Short Irving. Big Short Fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread, schlepping a salami and pumpernickel bread. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked into Saul's saloon like a man insane and ordered 3 fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
That was a Two Jewish classic, The Ballad of Irving, redefining the word classic. Nowadays, of course, we Southwestern Jews are much more sophisticated and braver than Irving, but some of us still wear Levi's and ride horses for fun, if not always transportation. Why, in season, we even dress up our saguaro cacti like Hanukkah menorahs. Anyway, in that spirit, from silly Jewish Western tunes, we turn to sillier Jewish Western tunes. In the spirit of Rodeo Week, that biggest Western celebration of the year in our very Western city, saddle your horse, join in the fun as we honor our Jewish Western heritage with a brief medley of the late great musical comedian Mickey Katz's Western parodies, Borscht Riders in the Sky and the Yiddish Mule Song.
Hello, Kapunch went out to lunch beyond the pearly gates. He walked into a vegetarian restaurant called Nate's. Tied a nice gepoop cat from flying with his horse. Come eat sure as he'll not give me a plate of borscht. Yippee ho! Yippee borscht ding dong! The borscht riders in the sky. You think? Blessings all still. Hey, clippity clop, clop, and cop, go ahead. Hey, Misha took a taxi instead. Clippity clop, keep a hot, drag a hog, get dropped dead. Need a long little donkey. Hey, there's a package of salami for a man down in Miami. There's a load of lox and bagel for a cowboy in Las Vegas. There's a dress of Skinner Sheffin for a lead fuck in Manhattan. Get along, yo! Hey, he gets all the round off to Bahama. Hey, there's a couple false Eugen for a shamus in Sheboygan. There's a very snazzy hippie for a girl in Mississippi. There's a ballybottish vanna for a schmohawk in the honor. Get along, yo! There's chicken zipsy pipsy for a shoychet in Poughkeepsie. There's a shaitel for a bobby in the wilds of Manitoba. There's a messer in diploma for a boil in Oklahoma. Get along, yo! Get along, no jump shit. Hey, since you're walking the places. Hey, my aching back. You know, boys, I'll tell you the truth. The next time I think I'll fly United.
The inimitable Mickey Katz, warping Western tunes for Jewish purposes. In any case, that's enough silliness for this upcoming Rodeo Week in Tucson. By the way, Mickey Katz's son was the fine actor and singer Joel Grey, Oscar-winning star of the movie Cabaret. His granddaughter is Jennifer Grey, star of the film Dirty Dancing and the recent TV series Fair Oaks. Mickey himself was a master of shtick and a fine musician, and now, quite recently, his name is dedicated to a chair in the UCLA Department of Music. In fact, our guest this morning, in a few moments on Too Jewish, will be Professor Mark Kliegman, the very first Mickey Katz Chair of Jewish Music in the Herb Alpert School of Music at my own alma mater, UCLA. Meet a true expert on Jewish music and the occupant of that chair when we come back on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Mark Kliegman is the Mickey Katz Chair of Jewish Music. He's in the Herb Alpert School of Music at UCLA in the Department of Ethnomusicology as well. He'll explain that. He's the first person to hold this newly created position. He is an expert originally, well, in Jewish music broadly, and particularly the music of the Edot HaMizrach, the Middle Eastern Jewish communities. His book on the music of the Syrian Jews of Brooklyn, Makam and Liturgy, was published in 2009. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish. Tell me about the Mickey Katz Chair, which has all kinds of implications for people who have known much about Jewish music, Jewish popular music for a while.
Sure. Katz Endowed Chair was set up by the family of Mickey Katz, and it was a way to keep their father's memory alive and for his contributions in Jewish music. Of course, Mickey Katz was a well-known parody musician from the late 40s into the very active into the 1960s, and this is the first endowed chair position at a research university in the United States, and it gives a way for Jewish music to be prominent at UCLA, and my activities really entail trying to encourage the scholarship, the creation, and performance of Jewish music.
Jewish music has been defined a lot of different ways. If someone were to ask you, as they must occasionally, what is Jewish music? How would you define it briefly?
I would define it in terms of the context that I typically look at it is music. Jewish music is music with the intention of being Jewish. So most of the music that I have looked at has been liturgical Jewish music, which of course is meant to be performed in the synagogue. And then there's different forms of popular music where people are trying to express themselves Jewishly outside of the synagogue context. But the point that it gets to be very interesting is, what about composers who are born Jewish, who are not expressing themselves Jewishly? Do we find Jewishness somehow hidden in their music? And that's always a very interesting question that one discovers in terms of looking at Jewish music, and the same thing is really within Jewish art. But I of the musical endeavor.
You have worked both in kind of classical Jewish forms, and you've also studied the development of popular Jewish music, I assume both liturgical and in other forms. What linkage do you find between contemporary Jewish music and more traditional?
Well, it depends on the contemporary Jewish music. A lot of the contemporary Jewish music that I've recently been looking at is music in the Orthodox community. And the linkage that that music has is really the intention of expressing some Jewish idea or some Jewish concept. But the musical expression of it may not be particularly something identifiably Jewish, where on the other hand, the Klezmer Revival, just to give another contrasting example, is filled with people who are not necessarily themselves religiously committed to Judaism, but want to have some sort of spiritual or personal connection to Judaism, and their the sound of that music, of Klezmer music, has to retain something that has some connection to Jewish Klezmer music in terms of the scale, the mode, the sound, the feeling, the form. And there, the linkage is in some ways more overt musically. So it really does depend upon the context. But by and large, with a lot of the new music that's been created in the popular idiom that you see on YouTube and many other contexts, it's really somehow a Jewish concept or a Jewish idea that they're really trying to express.
We will talk much more with Professor Mark Kligman about Jewish music broadly and narrowly when we return in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts. We have less than 9 months till we elect a new president of the United States, and we continue our election year feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. It's hard not to have all the Jewish news be about the only Jewish presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, and this week it proved to be impossible, so here goes. Last week, Representative Keith Ellison, the first Muslim ever elected to Congress, endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders for the Democratic presidential nomination. "This is a believe in the possibilities we can do together kind of campaign," said Ellison, Democrat from Minnesota. He introduced Sanders at the Black America Forum in Minneapolis. "This is the right campaign if you believe this country can be better than it was," he added, calling Sanders my dear friend and saying that Sanders believes in true racial justice and equality. In endorsing Bernie Sanders for president over Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State and Senator, of course, Keith Ellison went against the leadership of the Congressional Black Caucus. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we started talking about diaspora communities, the ancient Edot HaMizrach, the communities of the East that date back to the first destruction of the temple by the Babylonians in 586 and the centuries thereafter. You know, one of the great Jewish communities in the world for many centuries was the Syrian Jewish community. It's hard to think of that with the horrible civil war in Syria and the long antipathy of Syria to Israel. But the Aleppo Codex, so many great and important, there were many important Jewish scholars. It's an interesting community.
Yeah, let me just add that during most of those centuries, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman rulers were very friendly towards the Jews, encouraged Jewish settlement, and provided ample opportunity for Jews to prosper, to educate their children, and to advance in society. Not only that, but because they were tolerant and built a diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-national empire, Syria also was home to many Christians, and particularly the Armenian community found a home and a haven in Aleppo. So traditionally, the Syrian Jews divided themselves into two categories, although there were probably small communities throughout Syria in every big city. They identified themselves either as Halabi, which was connected to Aleppo, or as Damascene, which was connected to Damascus.
Right, it, almost like the two communities were totally separate.
Well, they had at least slightly different traditions, different tunes, different foods. And, I mean, even today, if you visit Syria, well, I don't know what it's like.
I don't recommend anybody visit Syria right now.
I was going to say, I don't know what it's like in the wake of the most recent civil war. But if you visited Syria 10 or 20 years ago, there is a remarkable difference between Damascus, which is one of the oldest cities in the world, and Aleppo, which feels like a crusader town. I mean, there's this giant citadel, and there's some amazing architecture and a great, rich history of Jews and Christians, as well as Muslims, who all coexisted and thrived under Ottoman rule for, you know, nearly 1,000 years. I'm exaggerating
only
slightly.
Hundreds of years anyway, right?
Well, at least, let's say 750 years anyway. Right. So today, there are very, very few Jews left in Syria. And those who are living there are probably not very open about their Jewishness. Many have left since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Some even left before. And they found themselves in an odd variety of places. And one of the big concentrations of Syrian Jews was in Brooklyn, New York, where all kinds of other Jews also found a haven.
Yeah, not an unusual place for Jews to migrate.
Lots of particularly Orthodox Jews and Hasidic Jews and sort of what some people might consider even like extremist sects of Judaism found a place in Brooklyn, but also Panama City, Panama. most Jews in Panama City are one way or another Syrian Jews. They're either Halabis or Damascenes, and they have their separate institutions, separate synagogues, separate country clubs, whatever, but they mostly hail from Syria. And, you know, who knows why and how they ended up there? I certainly don't.
Fascinating. I know there's also concentrations in New Jersey, and I've attended the Aleppo Synagogue many times in Jerusalem, which has a whole Halabi, a whole arc, and really a whole wall that they brought over from Aleppo at the beginning of the 20th century when they moved to Israel, more or less en masse. Interesting Jewish community and very, you know, great diaspora history.
Right. As they saw the end of the Ottoman Empire approaching, a lot of people from Ottoman provinces chose to get up and leave because they were afraid of what the new world order might be at the end of World War One.
Yeah, of course. I might also add the Syrian Jewish music is also unique, Nosach, very interesting musically. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi 9, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Oshrat, I like to say that Israelis, maybe all Jews, but particularly Israelis, have both the longest and the shortest memories in the world. They can remember the exodus from Egypt like it happened yesterday, which is more than 3,200 years ago. They remember the destruction of the temple in the year 586 BCE or the year 70, and they mourn it, and they go to the wall, and they remember forever, and then they forget that a year and a half ago, Jerusalem had alarms and there were missiles landing near Tel Aviv. And they go about their business and continue to grow the country.
You know the old story when you see someone, the old joke, when you see someone in the street and you say, oh, your face is familiar and you can find and say, oh, we met in Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
So we have a very long memory.
And
as we talked before, you know, it gives us, I think, as an Israeli, these strong stories, that our, you know, the roots gives us the ability to really overcome chick-chack on things that happened, like chick-chack, I don't know how to translate chick-chack, like chick-chack on things that happened like, you know, 5 minutes ago or yesterday. And we mentioned the mother of six that was murdered, you know,
not
few weeks
ago. Right.
And you know, in
stabbed
front of
in front
her kids.
Of her family, she protected the family.
It was Friday, you know, a few weeks ago. And then
right.
I think because we do, the Israelis and of course the Jewish people have we have goal here. We have like a burden of goal to be Ola Goyim and
the light to the nations, great people, right?
So I think it gives us a purpose to our life and we take everything in proportion.
It's fascinating. You know, one of the principles of resiliency, we had a guest on the show not too long ago, Dr. Robert Brooks, who teaches about resiliency. Resiliency is the ability to bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody goes through bad stuff. People think Israel is a country that's constantly traumatized. There's terror attacks, explosions. Well, some of that's true. But for Israelis, it happens and they go right on. And it's amazing. It's an amazing quality. Do you think that's what contributes to Israel's dynamism and economy and research? Or is it just...
Definitely. Everything is like piece of cake, you know, when you compare it. And, you know, one of the movie that we talked about, and
And a recent guest on Too Jewish, Laura Bialas, who's an old friend. It's a great film. About Sderot and the rock in the red zone.
So Avi Vaknin, one of the musicians, he said, you know, musician from Tel Aviv writes about love and, you know, how they are sad when their loved one leaves, you know, abandoned. And we in Sderot say, what are you talking about? At least you have your own body. You have, like, it's
you're healthy. You can walk around.
Yeah,
you can
exactly
sing.
His words.
What are you kvetching about your love life like that?
Yeah.
It's a great lesson.
And by the way, Tel Aviv is also in Israel. So it's funny that even in this very small country, there is musicians that see different the reality. It's more safer in Tel Aviv than Sderot. Okay.
No, that's right.
Last year, it wasn't so safe in Tel Aviv, but who remembers?
Right. And now there's people partying in great restaurants. Yeah. And music and art and all kinds of things. Thanks very much, Oshrat. We will talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Boker Tov.
Boker Or. We started talking last week about the challenge and the opportunity in developing Jewish education in a contemporary world, dealing with this enormous tradition, 3,800 years.
Yeah.
Talked about the ways that we teach now and the kinds of teaching we encourage. Let's talk about curriculum, content, you know, the classic cheder was, you know, you started with Torah, and then you went through Tanakh, and then you got the Parshanut, the commentaries, and then you did Mishnah and Gemara, you had Talmud,
and
that could take you till you're about 14 years old. So.
Sure. Well, that's a lifetime of study also.
It is, of course.
At THA, we have a lot of things in play, including the traditional approach with Torah study, the Parshat HaShavuah, Mishnah, Rashi, and so forth. But, you know, what's exciting also about Judaism is that we're a living entity, and Jewish religious practice, Jewish traditions, Jewish life is about the things that we do, right? And so there are so many exciting things to do as a Jew, and there are things that will appeal greatly to kids at a kindergarten level, and you know that might not be as interesting to an eighth grader. And so honing in on those activities, those experiences, are critical part of the curriculum.
So you have to make choices always, right? You can't teach everything at every age level. And, do you end up having to make a choice between teaching, Midrash or contemporary Israeli history? Like, how do you make those
sure.
kinds of choices?
Well, we have age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate content. And so you'll see, in the lower grades, more of a hands-on type of an experience. So as kids in first grade, for example, are learning the Aleph Bet, they'll go on a treasure hunt to find words. They'll have a celebration and earn a medal at the end of a unit of study. They're not quite as ready to tackle Rashi in first grade.
No.
And so that kind of content's offered to older kids.
No, second grade, maybe.
Well, our traditional track does start at second grade. And Rabbi Bigelman does teach, what's appropriate at a second grade level.
Right. It's always so interesting seeing kids grow. And of course, children are individuals. They have different skill sets. They have different aptitudes.
Yeah.
But I will say, you might think that because Rashi was writing 1,000 years ago, he's not relevant today, nearly 1,000 years
ago. He's absolutely relevant because those themes and topics that we struggle with over the eons are as relevant today as they were yesterday. And to have a spiritual leader like Rabbi Billy with his passion and his enthusiasm, you can't not love being a Jew and going through the experience. So, getting that fire in the belly, the ruach and the spirit, also really critical components of, like we talked last week, making things meaningful and relevant and loving the experience of being Jewish.
As you connect to these incredible texts. Thanks so much, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students, a rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Tour to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th. If you're interested in coming on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, email tojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a public service. A Western classic joke this time for the rodeo week. A gorgeous woman gets on a bus, distraught, and sits down next to a guy. She's visibly upset. Finally, she can contain herself no longer. She turns to the man and says, "I just saw my therapist. He says I have a big problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. She says, "I can't tell you. I don't even know you." The guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." The girl says, okay, my therapist just told me that I'm a nymphomaniac and I only like Jewish cowboys. Oh, by the way, now that you know, my name is Susan. And the guy says, hi, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisah, the story of the golden calf. It's one of the most dramatic and, for the rabbis of the Talmud, distressing parts of the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text, our people witnessed the 10 plagues, were personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, received the direct revelation at Sinai. In short, experienced God more directly than any other group in history ever had. And then, almost immediately, turned around and rejected God and worshipped the cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash call this week's events the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How can a people, given such a clear set of signs and wonders and even direct instruction and command, follow God for just 40 days before pursuing a weak and bovine substitute? The answer, to paraphrase Shakespeare, is not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, awed by it, but as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time indeed. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular observance, rules, schedules, the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism in later years. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent way, we flounder, even disastrously so, as we did in the story of the golden calf. The message is simply that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion, a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain both ethical and coherent. Without that focus, we start to worship golden calves of every kind. Our work, our pastime, our often unfortunate obsessions with power or control. This week, try to incorporate a Jewish practice you haven't previously done. A bit of Torah study, prayer, ritual, or tzedakah that haven't been a part of your regular life until now. Doing so will help you reconnect to the true God and avoid the danger of worshiping your own golden calves. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Mark Kligman, will explore what makes music Jewish and how the study of it enriches us culturally. Find out when we return shortly on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998 and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The King of Morocco sent a veteran Moroccan Jewish negotiator to push for a meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in order to renew peace talks. King Mohammed VI is trying to facilitate the meeting using Sam Ben Shitrit. Ben Shitrit is the founder and chairman of the World Federation of Moroccan Jews. On a number of occasions, he's acted as a middleman between Israel and Morocco, which don't have official diplomatic relations. Ben Shitrit arranged a meeting between several unnamed high-level Palestinian Authority and Israeli public officials just last week. Netanyahu and Abbas gave the okay for the meeting and even reportedly expressed willingness to meet in person. Netanyahu told Ben Shitrit that King Mohammed's plan is an opportunity to restart talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. In the recent meeting with Ben Shitrit, Abbas said he would be willing to meet with Netanyahu without agreed-upon preconditions for restarting negotiations. Ben Shitrit then sent a letter to Netanyahu, quoting Abbas, saying, "At the beginning of next month, I'll write a personal letter to Netanyahu proposing a meeting." The Israeli and Palestinian leader have not held an official meeting in over 5 years. They were photographed together in November of 2015, shaking hands on the sidelines of a climate change conference in Paris. After a group photo, Netanyahu and Abbas spoke a few words between them. "It's important for the world to see they were ready to talk," Netanyahu said later, but he stressed that it was just protocol. He has no illusions about Abu Mazen and so on. The prime minister has accused Abbas of incitement against Israel, lying about ostensible Israeli plans to change arrangements on the Temple Mount. Abbas has done that, and thereby playing a role in encouraging the ongoing wave of Palestinian stabbing terror attacks on Israelis. The King of Morocco's reported efforts to facilitate a new meeting come as a number of other international players are pushing for a renewal of peace talks. Meeting with Netanyahu in Jerusalem just last week, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Samantha Power reiterated America's commitment to advancing a two-state solution, as well as a peaceful resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. May God bring it about. Also last week, representatives of the Quartet of Middle East peacemakers announced plans to try to kickstart long, moribund negotiations between the two sides. It's not at all clear why the current pressure to revive long, dead negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians is happening now. Recent peace talks in Switzerland aimed at stopping the horrifying Syrian civil war have gone nowhere. Perhaps that makes the intractable Israeli-Palestinian divide seem more bridgeable. In other news, the Italian government released thousands of previously classified documents related to fascists and Nazi war crimes committed in Italy during World War II. The documents are declassified from a parliamentary commission that investigated the concealing of files related to those crimes. Specifically, the commission dealt with the Cabinet of Shame, quote-unquote, a physical wooden cabinet discovered in 1994 in a storeroom of the military prosecutor's headquarters, holding 695 files on war crimes that had been hidden for decades. The documents concern crimes ranging from anti-Jewish persecution to the massacre of civilians that resulted in a total of 15,000 deaths. Last week, the Italian Historical Archives of the Chamber of Deputies put an index of about 13,000 pages of material up on its website. The documents include declassified material from the investigating commission, as well as the original documents that were hidden in the Cabinet of Shame. Renzo Gattegna, the president of the Union of Italian Jewish Communities, called the move a historic breakthrough. Opening the Cabinet of Shame to the public fills a serious gap and announces the start of a new season of awareness about the crimes and responsibilities of fascism and Nazism in Italy. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews from around the world. To play our guest in, here's a flavor of the music of the Jews of Syria. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Mark Kligman. He is UCLA's inaugural Mickey Katz Professor of Jewish Music in the Herb Alpert School of Jewish Music. He is also involved in teaching in the Ethnomusicology Department. Can you explain the difference?
Sure. So So the field, the study of music, began with the definition of musicology as the way to study music, musicology. And that's a field that really was set up in by German intellectuals. And through the course of the study of music, I'd say around, over 100 years ago, by the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a desire to study non-Western music. And there were different approaches to how to study non-Western music, very much like how anthropologists were studying culture in different forms of different cultures. And as a study of non-Western culture really developed by the 1950s, the field of ethnomusicology developed. So the ethnomusicology means the study of culture and music. So the field of ethnomusicology is a younger field than the field of musicology. And the difference is with ethnomusicology is that the study of culture is synonymous with the music. So whether you're looking at music in culture, music as culture, music and culture, somehow culture is providing a very, very important element to that particular study. So ethnomusicology really follows the field of cultural anthropology. So in my particular case, my doctorate is both in musicology and ethnomusicology. So I'm in both departments at UCLA, and UCLA happens to separate out those fields as two different departments within the umbrella of the Herb Alpert School of Music. In many other music departments, they might just have ethnomusicologists and musicologists, and students are just a part of the Department of Music and then might choose the direction they go in. UCLA is a very, very large program, and they are now currently the largest ethnomusicology program in the United States. They're one of the first ethnomusicology departments formed in the United States. So it happens to be a separate department than musicology. And for me, studying Jewish music both as a culture, through culture, and in history is probably the best way, I feel, to really look at Jewish music.
In the interest of full disclosure, I have to admit you teach and have taught at two of my only two alma maters, UCLA and Hebrew Union College. I remember attending many music classes in Schoenberg Hall, but I wonder if Mickey Katz, when he started in Spike Jonze Orchestra, ever thought there'd be a chair in his name at a university.
Probably not. But Mickey Katz was a very, very clever man and a real humorist and really is sort of at the center of, I think, some very, very interesting things. You know, he, of course, was a parody musician, as you mentioned. He performed with Spike Jonze for a couple of years and recorded some classic examples of parody for Spike Jonze. And with that, Mickey Katz really started off his own form of Jewish parody, which was instantly popular. And his music really was based on well-known American themes. The first song that he did was called Hame Offen Range, you know, a parody of Home on the Range, where, you know, he's showing how, in a way, how uncomfortable Jews are, you know, being being in the country, being, you know, being frontiersmen. And
right. Hame Offen Range, kommt rein und bringt plenty of change, as I recall.
That's right, exactly. And the wonderful Yiddish parodies are just his great, you know, imagination. And he went on to record, I think, around 60 different parodies. But what's interesting, which a lot of people really don't know, is that in the late 40s through the early 50s, he created something called Borscht Capades, which was a Yiddish vaudeville production that he performed in Los Angeles. And it traveled to different places and actually had a six-month run in an off-Broadway production in the 1950s. And it was a way for him to sort of stitch a lot of these routines together. And his son, Joel Gray, was sort of his was featured in these productions. And then, of course, Joel Grey went out on his own to make his own name. So, you know, we remember Mickey Katz from the recordings, but he also did a lot of performances as well.
When a community, for example, the Syrian community you studied so deeply, is transplanted to other places, and, you know, you studied the Syrian Jews of Brooklyn. I'm very interested because one of my favorite synagogues is the Aleppo Synagogue, the Halabi Synagogue in Jerusalem, in which you can hear the Aleppo musical chant tradition, their nosach, if you will, really, I think, not terribly different from how it was when they moved there 100 years ago. How has that transformed when the Damascus and Aleppo communities were moved to the United States?
So the way that it has worked is that both the Damascus and Aleppo communities have moved to the United States, but the larger community is the Aleppo community. And, for example, in Brooklyn, there are probably about 25 different Syrian synagogues in Brooklyn, and the vast majority of them are from Aleppo. There are two that are from Damascus. Mexico City has the next largest number of Syrian Jews, and those Jews are mostly from Damascus. So looking at particularly the Aleppo traditions and how they've transplanted, in large measure, there was one particular cantor from Aleppo named Moses Ashkar, or changed his name to Moses Asher, and his students really perpetuated that tradition. So by the time that the community was in America in the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, part of their transplantation was making their community's liturgical traditions very much a part of their Jewish expression. And the Syrian Jews have always remained particularly united and together. And it's a very clannish community where they tend to, in large measure, socialize with each other, do business with each other, travel together. And there's this real sense of community that they've really clearly established. And now a community in Brooklyn, which might be, I mean, the estimates range between 60 or 65 and 75,000 Jews in Brooklyn, which is, of course, a very sizable number, it's very interesting that other Jews, such as the Greek Jews and Turkish Jews that traveled in similar numbers to the United States in different cities, really weren't able to remain together or grow as a community, because the reason to be Turkish or Greek wasn't a Greek Jew or a Turkish Jew didn't have the same import as being a Syrian Jew. For Syrian Jews, it really meant something to really be together and to remain as a community. And what essentially has developed is that the Aleppo traditions have continued in Brooklyn in different ways than they have in Israel. And what has happened in Israel is that the Aleppo Jews have developed a community that has intermixed with Jews from Iran, Iraq, parts of Morocco, Egypt, Lebanon, and they call themselves the Yerushalmi Sephardim. So that's a larger group in Israel, the Yerushalmi Sephardim, and their liturgy is based upon the Aleppo tradition, but it's a different development of this tradition. What the Syrian Jews do in Brooklyn is they keep this Aleppo tradition in a more stiltified or concretized fashion that really hasn't developed. And what that means is that in Brooklyn, there's not often new melodies that really come in. They really are adherent to an older crop of melodies and do things in an older type of style, whereas in the Yerushalmi Sephardim in Israel are developing this tradition in a new way. And there's a strong awareness of this, and sometimes, or many times, as new cantors come into Brooklyn, they're really brought in from Israel, from this Yerushalmi Sephardim tradition, and then have to readapt to be a part of the Aleppo Brooklyn tradition. So in large measure, the best way to say it is that the Aleppo tradition is an older tradition where trying to adhere to these older melodies or these older styles is what that tradition is.
I feel like we've just begun to scratch the surface. I want to thank Professor Mark Kliebman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about Jewish music and the Mickey Katz Chair in the UCLA Department of Music?
Well, they can just Google the UCLA Jewish Music, and then they'll find various activities and programs that we're doing. And we do a lot of very exciting programs at UCLA on Jewish music. And just to find out in general about Jewish music, there are a number of books, but if you just Google Jewish music, there's some interesting websites that one can find.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out appropriately and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be a fascinating younger rabbi, Susan Goldberg of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, discussing outreach and engaging millennial generation Jews. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Jews of Syria, Ata El Kabir, a piyut, a liturgical poem, sung by Eddie Ben Zakein and the Ensemble Modalius. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good rodeo week, and a week, we pray, of peace.